On occasion, my children sleepwalk, which is the source of great entertainment for me. Any sleepwalkers here? Sleep talk? Christine? Did you raise your hand, or were you getting a crocheting needle?
I was thinking about how your kids sleepwalk, and I'm going to be in the same room as one of them.
That's right. That should be fun. She actually does sleepwalk sometimes. So what I like to do when my kids sleepwalk, I feel like it's only fair that when they were babies, they woke me up a lot and caused me pain, so I should return the favor now. So I like to ask them funny questions and see what their responses are. So like, hey, did you see the unicorn in your room? And they're like, really? And various things like that. So it's really fun to kind of torment them a little bit. But I thought that was an interesting like picture of when you're sleepwalking, you seem awake, right? You're walking around, you're able to interact, and yet you're not aware, right? There's kind of like something that's not working, and you're just not living fully aware of what's going on. And the question I want us to be thinking about tonight for us is whether that describes us at all just in our daily lives, if we feel like we are in some ways sleepwalking through life. There's a sense that you know, life just goes on, you make decisions, you accumulate stuff, you accumulate relationships, you develop patterns, you develop habits, and life just kind of builds up to this point where you're living a certain way, you're living and you're making certain decisions, and then you kind of realize, what am I doing? You know, am I really aware? Have I really made the decisions to live this way? Have I really thought about everything? Are there ways that I need to be woken up, need to see something from a different perspective? Need to be kind of snapped out of it. And that's what is really good. That's a function that the prophets tend to serve in the Old Testament. The prophets were people that were outside the system. They weren't religious professionals. They weren't priests. They weren't Levites. They were independent. They weren't part of any hierarchy. So they could come in to the system. They could come into people's lives and they could say, what do you think you're doing? How is this okay? You can't live like this. Don't you remember? What about? The prophets were able to ask those types of questions because they were outside of things and they could come into a culture and just snap them awake and say, you don't realize what you're actually doing. And so tonight, as we look at Amos, we start to see him speaking to God's people that way. If you were here last week, we began the book, and we saw how Amos started off speaking to the nation of Israel, but first speaking to the nations around Israel. And so the beginning chapter of the book of Amos was a collection of oracles against the nations around Israel. And Amos kind of selectively centered all the way around the nation of Israel, picking all of Israel's neighbors, criticizing them, calling them to account for the things they were doing. This week, he zeroes in the circle, and he focuses on God's people themselves. When my kids are sleepwalking, if for some reason I need them to be awake, it's basically two ways to wake them up, right? Can you guess them?
Cold water.
Cold water, yeah. So that's one of the categories, is a dramatic action, right? Cold water, like a clap in their face, right? If it were dangerous, I would throw something at them, right? If they're like sleepwalking into a crowded street or something, right? Dramatic action, right? That snaps them out of it. What's another way? It's kind of similar. I don't know if it really counts. That would be an action. Words, right? You could yell at them, wake up! Hey, come on! Snap out of it. So I could say something to them or I could do something to them, right? Essentially, that's two ways that I could get them to snap out of it, to wake up. And for God's people, those are really the two things that he does for them to help them to wake up, to realize what's going on. He either says something to them through the prophets, or he does something to them through the circumstances that they face. And as we look at Amos, and as we look at the section tonight, we're going to see that what God does is he says something through Amos about what he's going to do. So both of those categories are there. He speaks to them through the prophet and he says, this is what I'm going to do in order to wake you up. And so for us thinking about it, we're going to be asking the question, what is God saying to us what words might God be using to snap us out of some situation we're in? And then also, what circumstances in our life have served to do that? How might God act in the future? And then even to recognize in the future if something happens, how is God using that to snap us out of some circumstance? So we're going to start with Amos 2, verses 4 to 5, and then we're going to read, we're going to go through the end of chapter 2 tonight, but we'll start with verses 4 to 5. So remember, last week we saw six different nations that God progressively moved through, criticizing all the nations around Israel. Now on chapter 4, or sorry, verse 4, chapter 2, he gets to Judah, which is the southern nation of Israel. But also remember that Amos is sent to Israel, the northern part of the kingdom. And so now he's speaking to the southern part. This is what he says in verse 4. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Judah and for four, I will not revoke the punishment, because they have rejected the law of the Lord and have not kept his statutes. But their lies have led them astray, those after which their fathers walked. So I will send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the strongholds of Jerusalem. So, if you remember it all from last week, there's this pattern to all of these oracles that Amos is following. He always says, for three transgressions and for four, I will not hold back. And then he goes into the issue that he has with these people. He levels the indictment against them, if you will. And then he says what the consequence is, what consequence he's going to bring because of what they're doing. So it follows the same pattern here. He says, for three transgressions of Judah and for four, I will not revoke the punishment. And he describes the indictment against Judah. And this is helpful because the things that he says are things that I think we can notice in our own lives. First thing, they have rejected the law of the Lord. Second thing, their lies have led them astray. And he points out that those lies are the same ones after which their fathers walked. So I want to think about those three things for a minute. First, he says they have rejected the law of the Lord. When God's people disobey him, when we disobey God, it's more than just breaking the law. It's more than just an abstract legal code that has been violated. God relates to his people as a father relates to his children, as a husband relates to his wife. It's a personal relationship. So what happens when that law is violated is it's a personal rejection of who God is. It's a break in the relationship. And this was made really clear to me when I became a parent, because you realize this on a really fundamental emotional level that, you know, I have children. If I were to tell my child, please don't touch that, and they touch it, it's not just that they violated some command. It's that we have a relationship. I'm their father. They're my child. And I've requested something of them, perhaps something that's extremely important, and they've chosen to ignore it. So that actually hurts. Like, it actually is really unpleasant to be disobeyed as a parent, especially of younger kids. And it's kind of like, well, what they've done is they've chosen to just devalue that relationship. And so that's what Amos says here. You have rejected the law of the Lord. It's this personal, you have turned away from God. It's not just a legal situation. It's a personal violation of a relationship. And then he points out that what's done that is because of their lies. The reason they've been led to do that is because of something false that they believe. They don't know where life is to be found. They have this false notion that if I do this, something good will come of it. But Amos points out that that's a lie. I think the same thing is true for us. The actions we take, the ways that we turn against God, for the most part we do it because we falsely believe that those things will bring us life, will bring us some positive experience. We've been studying the Gospel of John in main services this year, and one of the things I love about this gospel is John repeatedly comes back to this theme that real life, true life, the kind of life you really want to live, is found in Jesus and in Jesus alone. And so this lie that people believe is that something positive, some form of life is going to come by disobeying God. The last thing he says is he points out that this is not an isolated incident. It's not as if the people of Judah just came up with this way of acting. They inherited it. These are the lies that their fathers walked in, and now they walk in them as well. And that's helpful for us to think about, because I'd be willing to bet for each one of you, one of the most, probably the most determinative thing for you in terms of the values you hold and the decisions you make are your parents or the people that raised you, that poured into you as a younger person. That's where you learn what's right and what's wrong. That's where you learn which is more important in different situations. And you can certainly have different values than your parents. And you can certainly choose to say, actually, my parents value this and I don't value that, or I value something else. But that's a very intentional choice to turn away from the values of your parents. And this is why the prophets can be helpful, because sometimes we don't even realize that we just do things because that's the way we thought things ought to be done. That's all we've ever seen. I remember when my wife and I got married, one of our first big fights was how you load the dishwasher, right? Because clearly there is a right way and a wrong way to load the dishwasher. And these things are very important. But you don't think about it. You just think, this is the way dishes go in. And somebody else comes and does it a different way. And you're like, how could you possibly have lived this long loading dishwashers improperly? I mean, this is like a significant violation of the way the world should work. But where did we come up with this? It's just what we were taught. It's just completely unthinking. And yet that same thing carries on to way more significant areas of our lives, that we simply make decisions about relationships, about finances, about time, about careers, all sorts of things, simply because that's what we inherited. So Amos points out that this is what happened to Judah. They inherited what their fathers did. And partly that's what Amos can do, is say, wait, stop and think about these things. Think about the choices you've made. Don't just do them blindly. So for us, then these things are true for us. Oh, the other example is, I hope I'm not showing my age here too much, but have you guys seen this commercial? It's an old commercial. Probably some of you weren't born yet. But it's the old drug thing. Like, where did you get this stuff? How did you learn how to do this? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? Yes, I learned it from watching you. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, so I was going to show it. It's like 30 seconds. So this like guy comes in. It's from the 80s, so he's got this like really cool mustache and like really cool 80s hair. And comes in, he sits on his son's bed, and he's got like this box of marijuana. And he's like, son, how did you find this stuff? Why are you doing this? Where did you learn this? And the son like breaks down and he says, I learned it from watching you, Dad. And it's like drama. And the tagline is, parents who do drugs have kids who do drugs. Right? I know, right? Exactly. So anyway, that's what Amos is saying. Parents who disobey God have kids that disobey God. So, so for Israel, though, remember that Amos is sent to the northern kingdom. And so this is Judah. This is the southern kingdom. And how many oracles did we have before this? Six, right. So this is the seventh. So basically, if you were Israel and you were reading this, you heard Amos describe all the nations around you, and then the southern kingdom, which is kind of your like rival enemies, right? And you're going, phew, right? Seven, that's like the number of completion. We're done. It's like if I were to do this, right? What do you do? Right? You don't expect another one after that. If you hear the last two knocks, you're like, all right, the rhythm's done. So we've had seven oracles, and you'd go, this is great. We got spared, right? Amos has criticized everybody around us, but we got off scot-free. Except they didn't. In fact, this next section is really what Amos has been driving towards. And it comes as a surprise. Comes as a shock because you don't expect an eighth oracle tagged on to the seventh. But it's the longest of all of them by far. It's the most detailed, and this is really where Amos will spend the rest of the book unpacking, is speaking to the northern kingdom of Israel, pointing out what they've done wrong. So here's verses 6 to 16. Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not revoke the punishment. because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. Those who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and turn aside the way of the afflicted. A man and his father go in to the same girl, so that my holy name is profaned. They lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge, and in the house of their God they drink the wine of those who have been fined. Yet it was I who destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and who was as strong as the oaks. I destroyed his fruit above and his roots beneath. Also it was I who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, and led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorites. And I raised up some of your sons for prophets, and some of your young men for Nazarites. Is it not indeed so, O people of Israel? Declares the Lord. But you made the Nazarites drink wine, and commanded the prophets, saying, You shall not prophesy. Behold, I will press you down in your place, as a cart full of sheaves presses down. Flight shall perish from the swift, and the strong shall not retain his strength, nor shall the mighty save his life. He who handles the bow shall not stand, and he who is swift of foot shall not save himself. Nor shall he who rides the horse save his life, and he who is stout of heart among the mighty shall flee away naked in that day, declares the Lord. So, Amos turns his focus. He's focused on the nations around, he's focused on Judah, now he zeroes in on Israel. And this is the most detailed section. There's going to be three parts of this that we're going to look at. First, what Amos does is he lists the indictments against Israel. He says what they've done wrong. Second thing he does is that he describes why this is so incredible that these things would have been done, that Israel would do these things. And finally, he describes the consequences that he is going to bring upon Israel because of what they've done. So first thing, the indictments. It's interesting because if you look at there's a real shift in what God criticizes them for. If you remember the nations from last week, he criticizes them mostly for international sins, for attacking, for military brutality. He mostly criticizes them for their relationships with other nations, right? Particularly with God's people, with the Jewish nation. If you look at Judah, he mostly criticizes Judah for spiritual sins, for turning away from God, for believing lies. As you get to the nation of Israel, though, there's a certain type of sin that God seems to care about for these people. And those mostly have to do with actions, ways that people are treated, ways the relationships are handled within the country, within the people. They're mostly how people treat each other. And for the most part, they have to do with social issues, issues of class, issues of gender, issues of how economics is handled. This is what God seems to care about when he's talking to the nation of Israel. So these are the types of things he says. Verse 6, he says this. They sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. So we talked about last week how one of the nations was criticized for going into areas, kidnapping people, and selling them into slavery. Now he says, you guys do the same thing, but with your own people. You sell each other into slavery for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. This is meant to highlight the ridiculously low price that presumably a human life is worth. Now, Israel actually had rules that allowed people that were impoverished to sell themselves into slavery, to sell themselves into a kind of bonded servitude. But those rules were strictly regulated. There were parameters for how that was allowed, for what type of treatment was expected. There was compensation that was demanded when that happened. And so this is not talking about that. This is talking about the wealthy people, the people in power in the country, taking advantage of those rules and applying it unjustly. Doing it for people that were not indebted, selling the righteous into slavery. And when people were indebted, for giving them ridiculously low arrangements. And so it was completely not to their benefit. It was an abuse of power. That's the first thing. Then there's this criticism for oppressing the poor, trampling the head of the poor into the dust of the earth, turning aside the way of the afflicted. Again, this was the powerful people of the nation, those who had resources, oppressing those who didn't, not treating those in poverty well, not helping them out, not fulfilling the responsibilities that God had laid out in his law for how people in poverty were to be handled and helped in their situation. The next issue is a issue of sexual exploitation. It says, a man and his father go into the same girl so that my holy name is profaned. What's probably happening here is some form or some combination of sexual abuse. Perhaps it's rape. Perhaps it's sexual slavery. Whatever's being described, it's not a woman who is gladly and of her own consent choosing to sleep with both a man and his son. This is men taking advantage of women sexually in some form, whether this woman is a slave or whether she is poor or something. This is a situation that is sexual exploitation. And so that happens as well. God criticizes them. The final one is an economic situation. He says, they lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge, and in the house of their God they drink the wine of those who have been fined. So what this is this is taking advantage of people who have used debt because they need to. Israel had a law that if I owed you debt, you could take my garment, you could take my cloak, but you had to return it to me at night so that I could have something to keep myself warm at night. The picture here is of people who have taken something from a debtor. They have taken their cloak, and instead of returning at night, they're lying down. Not only are they lying down and keeping it for the night, they're doing so in the temple, or probably in some other temple. Probably this is combined with idolatry. And not only are they doing that, they're having a party. They're drinking wine, and they're kind of laughing in the face of those who are suffering by keeping their property, celebrating with it, drinking the wine of those who were fined. It's this kind of exuberant, celebrative, rich, having a good time while the poor suffer. Exploitation of the economic systems of the day. That's what's being described. So, for us then, these situations, oppression of those in poverty, sexual exploitation, economic policies of debt that are oppressive and hardship, selling poor into slavery, we might think about those as economic systems again that make it very difficult for those who are poor to survive. We certainly have to give some thought to what of those situations is present in our culture. And I would say that all of them are. And it makes us stop and think and ask, well, if this is what God cares about for his people, if this is the issue that he's drilling down on, what does that mean for us? How do we respond to this situation? And it's a very fair criticism to say that, in general, the evangelical church has not dealt with these issues as significantly as they have dealt with other issues. Now, that's starting to change. There are a lot of movements, and there is something really encouraging about that. But in general, and I would say this, to be specific, white and Asian Christian evangelicalism, which is probably most of us in this room, not exclusively, but for the most part, white and Asian evangelicalism has not focused on these issues. And I would say that for two reasons. One, because it's just easier not to, right? These are hard issues. It's a lot easier to address other cultural issues of sexuality, sexual preferences, of stuff like that. Second, for the most part, whites and Asians haven't been the victims of these types of systems. And so there's a whole less motivation to deal with these issues when you're not feeling the pain. Now, there are Latino and African American evangelicalism has tended to focus primarily on these issues for sometimes the opposite reasons. And so, again, this isn't exclusive, but PBC and YAF, we are generally characterized by whites and Asians. And so we need to ask the tough question, do we care about this? Are we willing to step out in this way? Have we overlooked this because it's easier not to, and because, frankly, it hasn't affected us all that much? I want to bring up one issue that, just in thinking about this, is something that we might give some thought to. And it's an issue that we actually do talk about in the church, but I think we don't think about this as a social justice issue, and that's the issue of pornography. So in thinking about this, I did some research and kind of keying off this idea of sexual exploitation. In general, when we think of pornography in the church, and when we talk about it as a personal sin, as a character issue, we tend to care about personal holiness as kind of the highest thing, rather than systemic cultural issues, right? So when we think about pornography, we think about that as an issue of personal holiness. But I was doing some research, and there's this woman who's actually, she's not a Christian. As far as I can tell, she isn't a woman of faith at all in any religious system. Her name is Gail Dines, and she's written a book called Pornland: How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. And she describes kind of going into the world of the production of pornography and some of the consequences that happen within that world, but also some of the consequences of that industry, which is 100% an economic industry. That's why porn exists, to make money. And it makes a lot of it. It's a huge industry. So she goes into this industry, and she also kind of helps to unpack how that industry affects our culture, affects us as individuals in thinking about our sexuality, affects men, affects women. And I want to just think about, and what one of the things she points out about pornography is the increasing prevalence of violent, oppressive depiction of acts that are clearly not consensual, extreme sexual acts that are being presented in porn. And think about what effect that has on a culture, both a national culture and an international culture. And think about some of the issues in terms of social justice that we face as a culture, issues of sexual slavery that are happening in our world. And you think, well, is it possible that the prevalence of pornography that depicts non-consensual acts contributes to that? It could be hard to say that that isn't related. Think about violence against women. You know, there's been a lot of sexual violence against women in India that has received a lot of national press lately, or international press, but certainly violence against women is always an issue. And you think, well, how does the prevalence of violent pornography play into that? Think about areas of the world where the sex industry is common and is lucrative. We partner with a missionary couple that works in Thailand, and they run a home for women that are trying to get out of the sex industry. And the stories of these women are largely the same. They largely grew up in rural areas, in agricultural areas, and often they or their families found out that if you move to the city and you become a sex worker, you can make a whole lot more than you can working on the farms in the village. And so these young women would go to the cities, become sex workers, and send money back to their families. So you think about how sexuality and the growing demand for sex workers affects even the economy and the urbanization and the move away from agriculture for whole countries, whole economic systems. And then you think about our country, the effect on families, the effect on faithfulness in marriages, the effect on children growing up in broken homes. And certainly there are a ton of factors. That's not to say that, you know, before there was internet porn, families were 100% great, right? You can't blame it on that. And yet, think about the way that particular form of sexual exploitation ripples outward throughout us as individuals, our country, our world, and just causes issues upon issues upon issues. I think this was interesting for me to think about, that pornography could be a social justice issue. But I think it is. I think there are real ramifications of that. The question then is, well, what do you do, right? I don't know. Ask God to lead us? Something. So the question then is, which of these things do we see in our culture? Which of these things do we see in our lives? And how do we respond to them? And those are hard questions. Those are hard questions that we have to be in prayer about. We have to be in conversation about as a community. Maybe some of that will happen as we study Amos. And these are issues that will come up week after week. This isn't like a one-shot deal and now we get to go on and think about nice stuff. You know, we're going to be thinking about this, and maybe there are ways that we challenge each other. Maybe there are issues that we can get involved in as a community. So I'd encourage you to be thinking that way, to be praying about that, to come up with ideas. We are a place where we really encourage, you know, it's one of the strong values of our church and of our fellowship as well, is it's not like the pastors run things. We are a body that we run things. Ideas come from everywhere, and the best stuff that happens at this church always happens from people with great ideas and a passion to see it get done. So those are ways you can be thinking. So that's the first thing that Amos does. He lists these indictments against the people. And then he says why this is so incredible and so remarkable that this would happen. And essentially he says, don't you remember who I am? He says, I'm the God that conquered the Amorites for you. I'm the God that gave you the land. I'm the God that brought you out of Egypt. He says, I saved you. I provided for you. And then I gave you prophets and Nazarites to speak my word to you. I gave you my presence. I was with you. And so it's remarkable that you would do these things in violation of that relationship. Don't you remember the relationship that we have? And it's particularly interesting to hear how they responded to these two groups of people, the Nazarites and the prophets. So Nazarites were people that were marked out, they were called out from a young age to live a particularly significant spiritual lifestyle. Okay? These were not general population. They lived by stricter rules. They wouldn't drink any type of alcohol. They often lived in isolation. And these people were kind of, you know, the early example of the monks or the nuns or people that chose a radically simple lifestyle. And those people are helpful for any believing community to have because it helps us say, wow, you can live that way. That's not to say that we are all meant to live that way, but it provides an example for us. It provides a kind of mirror to say, wow, my life looks really different than their life. And it forces us to evaluate our lives. If it's possible to live so simply, why don't I? What things could I cut out? So Nazarites for God's people became this kind of example to check yourself against. The prophets, as we've already said, are God's way of speaking to his people, of saying words, of bringing truth to them. And so notice what God says these people did. Verse 12, you made the Nazarites drink wine. So God gave his people the Nazarites as examples to demonstrate a radically faithful life. And what did they do? They tempted them away from that. And this is kind of what I call like the college frat party trend, right? If you go to like college frat party and you're like, that's okay, I'm not going to drink. Like, everybody's like, oh, come on, have a drink. You know, there's this like pressure to like conform. And any display of boundaries or anything, it makes other people uncomfortable that you have boundaries. So they want you to relax your boundaries so they're less uncomfortable, right? You familiar with this type of dynamic? And so if there's a sin you struggle with, it's a whole lot more comfortable to be around people that struggle with the same sin. So if they don't, you're like, hey, come on, let's struggle with this together. Join in with me. And this is essentially what God's people did. They tempted the Nazarites away from their radical lifestyle because they felt guilty about their own choices. The second thing they did then is they talked to the prophets and they said, you don't really need to like say all that stuff that God says. You know, let's just like have a good time. Don't do that whole thus saith the Lord thing. You know, let's just like watch movies and have fun, right? They said to the prophets, do not prophesy. And so the question for us is, how do we respond to people whose lives challenge our decisions or people whose words challenge our decisions? Do we tempt people whose lives challenge our decisions away from making certain decisions because that makes us uncomfortable? Do we silence people who try to challenge us or ignore them? We can corrupt the examples of truth, and we can silence the voices of truth. I know I've done that. I think I've, you know, seen situations where I'm uncomfortable and it's a whole lot more comfortable to be with people that are acting like I am. So Amos lists all these indictments against Israel. He says why it's incredible. And finally, he says the consequences that's going to come. And essentially, this can be summed up by simply saying, you're going to get it. Okay? All those nations that I criticized, they're going to attack you. Some other nations are going to attack you. You're going to get it. And the way he describes them getting it is he lists out certain categories of people, and he says, the things that you think keep you safe won't work anymore. If you're strong, there'll be somebody stronger. If you're really good with a bow and arrow, it won't work. If you're whatever, he who is swift of foot shall not save himself. If you think you're fast, you're not going to be fast enough. So whatever it is that you think are your strengths, that you've relied upon to keep yourself safe, isn't going to work. For a while, when it first came out, my wife and I used to watch that show 24 on Netflix, right? This is maybe a little embarrassing, but we actually had to stop watching it because it gave me nightmares. I would, like, after watching an episode of 24, I would always wake up in the middle of the night with one of those dreams where you're, like, running in slow motion and, like, the person's catching up and you just, like, can't lift your legs and, like, they're catching up and I just, like, wake up, like, terrified. You know, it's like that awful feeling of, like, something's coming to get me and I can't escape it. Right? Am I the only one that has those dreams? No? Okay. So I, like, had those all the time after watching 24, so I can't watch it anymore. But that's essentially what is being described here. You think you're fast, you won't be fast enough. You think you can protect yourself, you're not good enough. Something's coming to get you, and you're not going to be able to escape. For us, then, I think it's interesting to think about what are the situations in life that we face, and how might God use them? And it's kind of a whole separate discussion, like, does God judge us? When we make mistakes, does he bring things specifically to challenge us? Does he use circumstances? We're not going to get into all of that right now. But if you think about the category of those situations where you get into and you realize, I can't do this. I can't handle this on my own. The abilities that I have relied upon up till now aren't sufficient to get me out of this situation. And when we face those opportunities, whether God is doing it intentionally, whether he's using those circumstances, those are chances to say, actually, that's right, I can't do this. My abilities aren't enough for this situation, but God is. And those are opportunities to return to God and say, I thought I was okay, but actually I need you. I need you in big ways. And that's what God does for his people. He puts them here in a situation that they can't get out of. And he says explicitly, I let the nations conquer you so that you would return to me, so that you would realize that you need me. And yet, too often, it doesn't work for them. For me, this was really brought home, and I've shared this before, I know, but my wife and I went through some really hard times in our marriage. And on top of the whole idea of, I mean, on top of the conflict in our relationship and the fights we were having, one of the hardest things for me was simply realizing, like, I thought I was prepared to be a good husband. I'd listened to all the sermons. I had all the right ideas. I was this, like, idealist, and I knew exactly how it would work, and we were going to be the best Christian couple, and we were going to have a godly marriage, and then it's like, it didn't work. We fought all the time. And I think if she wouldn't have had to raise three kids by herself, my wife probably would have left me. And she's told me that. And I had to get to a point where I said, I'm not equipped to be a good husband. I don't know how. The things I thought I had that would make me successful don't work. And those moments and that process of then saying, crying out, saying, God, we need help, going to marriage counseling and slowly starting to rebuild and figure out how to communicate and figure out what mistakes we'd been making. That was some of the most raw times of my life, but it was the times where I was most aware of God's presence, of God saying, you know what? Truth is, you're not a good husband, but you can ask for forgiveness, and I'll be there. And I saw God work in incredibly powerful ways during that time. And there have been other times since then similar, but for me, that was probably the most dramatic case of me just saying, my abilities aren't sufficient to do what I thought I could do. God, I need you. And that's the place that God puts his people here. So ultimately then, everything returns to God. Whether we are convicted and we change and we say, actually, I want to do something about this. And we do that for God's glory, to live the way He asks us to live. It all goes back to God. If we don't, and we get thrown to the ground and knocked on our backs, and we cry out, God, I can't do this, I need your help. It all comes back to God's glory. Whether we choose Him or not, it all comes back to God's glory. And that's what happens here in this passage. So, back to the question we started with. Are we, in some ways, sleepwalking through life? Are there ways that we just aren't aware of things? That we're living on a plane and there's something else that we just, if we'd open our eyes, we'd see it. The answer's got to be yes for all of us, right? I mean, for every single one of us, there are areas that have gone unconsidered and patterns from our families or from our own choices that aren't good. And yet, what's true in the midst of that is that God's there. God cares enough for His people that He does something about it. He speaks to them, and then He acts for them to help them come back to Him. And so the place to start for us then is to say, yes, sin is real in our lives. Sin is real in our culture. Sin is endemic everywhere. To start from that place of brokenness and say, God, I need you. We need you. Our country needs you. What can we do? How can you use us? We're broken by sin. And yet, the message of the gospel is that we're free from sin. Sin is present. It is real. And yet, because of what Jesus has done, we're free from it, not just from a legal perspective where we're not, you know, we're forgiven, but we are free from the effects of it. We can act in ways that weren't available to us before, and we can be bold and take risks because we know that that freedom is the condition that we're in. And that's exciting, to say, what can we do in the world? How can we act because we're free? We don't have to worry about it. And we can move forward seeing how God might use us. So the question to leave you with then is, what do we do? I think first we go back to God and we say, I'm broken. For the ways that I've contributed to this, I need forgiveness. For the ways that I've been unaware of it, I need to become aware of it. I need my eyes opened. And for the ways that you want to use me to make an impact in the world, show me. We don't have to manufacture something. We don't have to come up with our own ideas. God will lead us. That's what God does if we're open and if we invite Him into it.